Last November, history was made when Admiral Lisa Franchetti assumed office as the 33rd Chief of Naval Operations, becoming in the process the first woman on the Joint Chiefs of Staff. In this role, Admiral Franchetti leads the U.S. Navy as China continues to test the boundaries of the international rules-based order across the Indo-Pacific and globally, while Russia, in the maritime environment, remains a capable adversary. As the U.S. Navy works to promote U.S. national prosperity and security, Admiral Franchetti is prioritizing investment in the defense industrial base and the growth of the fleet, all topics we're going to get into today. I'm Dr. Kathleen McGinnis, and this is Smart Women, Smart Power.
This is Smart Women, Smart Power, a podcast that features conversations with some of the world's most powerful women.
Well, first, welcome to Smart Women, Smart Power, Admiral Franchetti. We are just so honored to have you here. as the first woman on the Joint Chiefs of Staff, congratulations on there's so many women around the world, so many girls around the world looking at you and saying, yes, it can happen. We can do it. So thank you for being here. And thank you for being such an inspirational leader for so many.
Thank you. Well, thank you, Kathleen, for the chance to be here. And, you know, there's plenty of women role models that folks can look up to. And I've always said, if you can see it, you can be it.
Absolutely.
And, you know, I looked up to plenty of people along the way. And again, it's great to have the opportunity to be here with you today.
Well, so to get our conversation going, we love to get into our guests' origin stories. And like, and you are, you have been the pathbreaker in a number of capacities. You're the first CNO who commissioned through the Naval ROTC program. So what got you here? What inspired you to the service? And frankly, what also helped you keep you in the service?
Well, it's kind of a funny story.
Yeah.
And in fact, when I went to college, the Navy wasn't really even on my horizon.
Okay.
I went to Northwestern University. I was in the Medill School of Journalism. And as a freshman, I was wandering around campus and I happened upon a couple of guys that were out in a parking lot having a cookout and tossing around a football. And I stopped to chat with them and I said, hey, what are you all doing? And they said, oh, we're ROTC students. We're here at Northwestern, we're going to be Marines and we're going to be in the Navy. And, you know, oh, by the way, it's a great program. You can get $100 a month. You could get free books. I had just been to the bookstore. And books were expensive back then when we used to get books. And we could get you a scholarship. And I said, well, that sounds really interesting. And they said, well, why don't you come in and talk to our lieutenant? So I went down and over to the ROTC unit, which was in a house there. And I talked with the lieutenant, who was an aviator, A6 pilot. And he told me all about the program. And I said, well, I think I'll sign up. So I signed up right then and there. And I became an ROTC student at Northwestern. And, you know, I always say that journalism teaches you to be curious, ask a lot of questions, and be able to tell a story. So I still use those skills, even though I never became a journalist. You know, when I came in the Navy then, back in 1985, there were a lot of things that women could not do back then. And in fact, only 17 women a year were able to go serve on ships as officers at the time. And I wasn't one of them that got chosen initially. So in my first duty station up at Great Lakes, my command said, hey, we think you have what it takes to go out and be a surface warfare officer, and we're going to figure out how we can get you back to sea, out to sea. So it was really the initiative of my captain, Captain Gary Bear at the time, and you know, he was really pushing me to do that, and he worked with the Navy to send me to surface warfare officer school right in 1987. So, you know, as I proceeded through my career, the doors kind of started to open because there were changes in law, there were changes in policy, and ultimately changes in culture. So along the way, the Navy was able to open up combat logistics for ships to women. And then in 1993, they opened up combatant ships to women as well as combatant aircraft. And that was due to, you know, congressional action. So I was really happy to see that. And so I decided that this was going to be a path for me. And I was able to go to a destroyer right in the very beginning of that time frame. So although I joined for free college, I stayed for the mission, I stayed for the teamwork, and I've really enjoyed being able to go around, all around the world, really, you know, as part of a representative of our nation, of democracy, of being that beacon of hope and being able to work with allies and partners all around the world with the same values. And that's why I stayed. Great teams and great people.
Great teams, great people. And I remember, I was actually speaking with a colleague about this earlier today. You know, when I joined this field of national security in the 90s, you know, we thought the Cold War was over and, you know, we're going to do crisis management in the Balkans. And but the security environment over the course of your career profoundly changed a couple of times. How, I just curious, as a digression, your perspective on those changes and how the Navy's been able to manage those strategic shifts.
Sure. It has been a lot of change during my time frame. Mm-hmm. Certainly, I came in the Cold War. You know, some of my initial deployments were focused on looking for, you know, Soviet submarines.
Right.
And so it was a very different time. I remember being underway on deployment when the Berlin Wall fell, getting the message news that we used to get on the ship saying that had happened.
And it must have been mind-blowing.
It really was.
Yeah.
It was a fascinating time. Mm-hmm. But, you know, then, you know, really working through the changes in the immediate aftermath of sort of the changes in Europe, all the different nations to work with, the continued strengthening of NATO and then different partners in NATO and having opportunities to work with them was really important. Mm-hmm. Then shifting, of course, into, you know, after 9/11, especially the global war on terror and responsibilities for supporting our power projection mission, really came to the fore. And I think as you see us now with strategic competition and challenges with the PRC, with Russia, as you mentioned earlier, you know, really thinking hard about our sea control mission, what we need to think about and what capabilities we need to be able to do that, sea denial, while continuing power projection, maritime security. You know, there are so many things that the Navy brings to our nation every day.
Absolutely.
It's been good to see us, you know, be able to perform each one of those main missions of the Navy, regardless of the geostrategic situation.
Right. The dynamism is absolutely incredible. Mm-hmm. You think, and the breadth of the mission set is also just, well, breathtaking. The U.S. Navy, not to quote a slogan, but it really is a force for good. And here in the United States, we're a maritime nation. The seas are absolutely the lifeblood of our economy, our national security, our way of life. And so can you share some of the key factors that are, in your mind, changing the way the Navy executes its mission?
Sure. I mean, as you said, we are a maritime nation. You know, 90% of the global economy operates on the sea. Yeah. You know, you don't really think about it a lot, but $11 trillion of financial transactions go through undersea cables, you know, every day. So there's a significant amount of impact that the oceans have. And really, that's our domain. That's where we work, you know, on, under, above the sea, seabed to space, everything in between. So, you know, the Navy really needs to think about that and how we interact with the joint force. I think some of the things that are changing or the things that are being recognized, you know, in the 2023 NDAA, Congress actually codified our mission to reflect both the national security mission that we provide every day, providing for the maritime prosperity and security of the nation, as well as our responsibility to provide for prompt combat incident to the sea. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we take both of those missions very seriously and train to them, recognizing that, you know, we have a lot of capabilities in the high end area, but we also need to be able to preserve that security, as you can see us doing today, really all around the world. Mm-hmm. I think the other factors that I would say are front and foremost in my mind are China, of course, as our national defense strategy discusses our pacing challenge. Yeah. You know, certainly a nation that has developed capabilities. They certainly have the ability to attempt to reshape the rules-based international order to their favor. Mm-hmm. And certainly a lot of things that we are focused on as we develop a combat-credible Navy is really, I've put out in my America's Warfighting Navy, they're focusing on, you know, warfighting, warfighters, and the foundation that supports them. I think the third change that I see is a lot in the changing character of war. You know, you can look at Azerbaijan and Armenia, Russia's horrific invasion of Ukraine, and even what's going on now in the Red Sea, as you see these unmanned technologies A lot of disruptive technology starting to really play a role in warfare. Mm-hmm. And again, as navies, as all our militaries adapt, you know, we have to adapt to that changing character of war. So I'm focused on, you know, that those two things as things that are really driving the decisions that we have to make as a Navy in all those areas, whether it's warfighting capabilities, how we train our warfighters, and all the foundation that we have in our infrastructure, our bases, our aircraft carriers that don't get underway to project that power.
To drill down a little bit into Russia, you know, the Biden administration's national defense strategy defines Russia as this acute threat. In your opinion, what is the U.S. Navy's top concern when it comes to Russia?
Well, I think as you look at Russia, it's a very has always been a very capable Navy in the undersea domain. So I think this is the area that I'm mostly concerned about. Of course, though, Russia always remains an existential threat from the nuclear weapon capability. So, you know, from that perspective, those are the two key areas that I think I'm concerned about. The when you think more broadly about, you know, Russia and the impact this war is having on their future ability to project power, you see all the Ukrainian successes in attacking ships and destroying Russian future capability. Again, it will be really interesting to see where Russia and where Putin prioritizes his efforts. But I'm certain that one of them will be in the undersea domain.
Interesting. And, you know, as you mentioned, China continues to test the boundaries with the international rules-based world order. More specifically, how is the U.S. Navy going to address these concerns and gray zone operations that, that China is conducting in the maritime space? How are you thinking about that, and how is the Navy responding to that, I mean, increasingly urgent challenge?
Well, you know, our Pacific Fleet is incredibly capable. And, you know, I like to say we operate forward at the point of friction, which is what you're talking about, but we also operate forward at the point of friendship. And, you know, I think one of the key strategic advantages we really have are our allies and partners there in the Pacific. Of course, we have 60% of our Navy is in the Pacific. We put our most capable forces in the Pacific. So I know that we provide a very credible deterrent force in the Pacific every day just by operating far forward. But we also operate every day with allies and partners. And I think that is something that none of our potential adversaries could claim. You know, right now we just started Balikatan. That's a big exercise that we're doing there with the Philippines, but also being joined this year by France and Australia. You know, we've just finished up a good quadrilateral exercise with us, with the Philippines, with Japan and Australia. So a lot of opportunities. We'll be doing RIMPAC, which is our Rim of the Pacific exercise this year. And we're really excited about all of those opportunities to learn together, build our interoperability. So those are some of the ways that we're providing that ever-present force in the Pacific, really to deter any malign activities there.
Well, to expand a little bit further, go a little bit more deeply, when you're doing, because you've led across the globe, you know, in Korea, Europe, Africa, and you have a very tactile sense of what our allies and partners bring to the table. So what can the U.S. and specifically the Navy improve on to be able to harness those capabilities, to integrate our partners into our operations and our concepts and our and how we do business?
Yeah, well, I really have had great opportunities to work with allies and partners really over these last 38 years. And I couldn't be a bigger proponent of working very closely with them. We just had the International Sea Power Symposium last September. We had 94 different heads of navies and coast guards there for a whole week up in Newport. And it's incredible to think about that great big maritime, I call it the maritime links in the chain. So, you know, every Navy brings something to the table. All of the navies are reliant on the oceans, you know, for their own national security and prosperity, and bringing them all together and ensuring that everyone does understand that whether the Navy is big or small, they all can contribute. They all have capabilities that we can together work to, again, preserve that rules-based international order that supports all of us. I think the things that we can improve on is always, you know, it's important to be able to share information with them. You know, most certainly, as you saw in the lead up to Russia's invasion of Ukraine, the opportunity to share information and build a coalition that is strong and stand strong and is continuing to stand strong, sharing information. I think building interoperability in at the very beginning when we're trying to develop our systems or our architectures for exercises or communications, that's all really important because you do need to be able to plug in. Some of my counterparts used to call it plug and play. You know, I think that's something that navies have a very unique capability to do because we're all operating in the same environment. And as long as you set up that architecture, you can connect, you can play, you can build coalitions. I think if you look back to you know, the British, when they deployed their carrier around into the Indo-Pacific back in 21, you know, all along the way, they picked up different nations. And then, of course, we had folks interacting with them from the U.S. Navy. But that's really the power of navies. And this coming year, I think the Italians are going to plan to deploy their carrier into the Indo-Pacific. And then the French after that into the following year, and then the, the Brits after that. So there's a lot of interoperability going on. And it's, you know, we're leading a lot of that, but so are our other partners. And it's really great to see that spark. I think also NATO, you know, getting Finland and Sweden joining. So that's more opportunities there. And of course, we have AUKUS, Pillar One, which of course will be the US, UK, and Australia working on submarine capabilities. But equally as important is the Pillar Two, you know, where we're working together on other things, you know, AI, cyber, undersea. And I think there could be opportunities for other nations, again, to build on some of those things that we're doing together.
That's terrific. I happened to do my PhD on more studies on coalition warfare and interoperability and how it is so hard to just get, you know, military force A, military force B to, like, work together. And so I'd love to hear, like, the continued prioritization of interoperability because it is a constant thing. It's not something that's a one and done. You can't tick the box on interoperability. No. It just has to be exercised. It has to be practiced. It has to be prioritized, right, every day in order to have it when you need it.
Yeah, every single day. And I think there's a lot of other things that, you know, you see going around in the maritime space, especially in float forces where we don't necessarily always have Navy ships. So if you look at Africa, you know, there are multiple European, South American navies that operate there. And a lot of maritime domain challenges there with illegal, unregulated fishing, still piracy. And, you know, we lead exercises in the all, you know, the north, the west, and the east coast of Africa, but so do other nations. So again, partnering together to keep that deterrent presence around, I think it's really important.
Absolutely. So we have a question from the audience. Different services have announced, you know, sweeping optimizations to maintain U.S. superiority amidst this great power competition. To what extent is the U.S. Navy involved in or impacted by this historic shift? And how will such a shift impact U.S. relations with the rest of the world?
Well, I think back to, you may remember the pivot to the Pacific.
Oh, right.
Back in 2011, which seems like a long time ago now. But the Navy really took that very seriously back then. And this is when we did actually move to put 60% of our forces over in the Indo-Pacific. We have moved our most capable forces into the Indo-Pacific. And of course, the Pacific Fleet controls its own forces. So, you know, we have really never left, you know, this concept of strategic competition, great power competition. This is really in, if you think about the maritime domain, the vast expanse of the Pacific and the things that we need to work on, I think our Navy is well postured and ready and has been operating in that space. I think, as I mentioned earlier, you know, we continue to develop those combat credible capabilities for there. You know, our priority, just like in the NDS, is to defend the homeland, prevent strategic attacks on the U.S. and our allies and partners. And it's also to continue to operate and maintain that rules-based international order every day for security and prosperity. And I think we're well postured to do that. So the shift that I see coming up is more about some of these disruptive or unmanned capabilities and you know, how as a Navy are we going to integrate them into what we do every day, not just as our own Navy, but with our allies and partners, and then as a joint force. So we've had some really good experimentation over in Fifth Fleet with our Task Force 59, integrating those different types of capabilities for maritime domain awareness. We then scaled those out to try them in Fourth Fleet down off of South America, and they're continuing to do some sailing down there to do that. And then even having unmanned units to go from San Diego all the way to Guam and Australia and back. So a lot of good learning in there. So if you think about, you know, the future of great powered competition, it's more players on the field, you know, every day. That involves platforms, it involves people, but it also involves how can we extend the lethality and the reach of our manned platforms by using unmanned platforms.
And taking advantage of innovation within, you know, our own military institutions, our economy, our business communities, and to be able to, you know, point them towards these problems and scale up. It's such an enormous challenge.
That's a really exciting thing, though, because, you know, certainly America has the most amazing innovation base, you know, in any nation in the world. And I think what we find is when we bring our challenges to that innovation space, people do have solutions. And then our job is to figure out how to quickly get them in the hands of the warfighters, let them test them out, and then get them out there so we can start using them. Yeah. And when I talk to all of my other heads of Navy, everyone is very interested in exploring the unmanned space and being able to figure out how to really multiply the effects that they can have with their own Navy in all their waters, because they see that the maritime is a very contested environment.
Yeah. Yeah. $11 trillion going through the cables and undersea. I mean, it's just incredible. Shifting gears a little bit, Smart and Smart Power, we've been doing a little bit of work on women, peace, and security related issues. So getting, love your thoughts on women's networks and how they can be utilized to advance democracy and help us counter authoritarianism. Neither Russia nor China really care about women, peace, and security or women's related issues. They seem to be doubling down on you know, golden age ideas of what it means to be a woman and a man, and women have to go home and have babies. But they've ceded the space on women, peace, and security, which to me means that we have an incredible opportunity to utilize that space and expand a competitive space with 50% of the global population. So with that as sort of, you know, sort of context, I'd be curious to see your views. How does the Navy think about women, peace, and security and its strategic utility?
Yeah, well, certainly, as you just mentioned, you know, 50% is more than 50%, I think, of the population.
That's true. That's true.
You know, that is, you know, it's an incredible amount of power. It's an incredible amount of brain space and an incredible amount of capability. So I always feel like ignoring any portion of our population writ large is really just doing yourself a disservice and putting yourself at a disadvantage. And I think we should really leverage and take advantage of every opportunity that we have as navies. I think, you know, we do have a leadership role in that space in a lot of parts of the world. I can only speak for my own experience as a fleet commander or things, you know, where you have opportunities to be that example really for other navies and talk to them about, you know, how we have integrated women into all of our platforms now. You know, we have a XO and a chief of the boat on a submarine now, which is, you know, really our last platform to integrate women. So we're very excited about that. But some of it is just sharing those ideas. And again, building those networks, as you talked about, to show that, you know, women are equally as capable as their male counterparts in this national security space and being able to take advantage of that. And I've seen great results from that, you know, had many opportunities both as Sixth Fleet to bring together, you know, lots of senior enlisted leadership, I think, is one of the key places where we do that, is where we talk not just about women, but really about empowering people in general. And, you know, the importance of having strong enlisted leadership, providing opportunities for people to be their best every day. You know, in the Navy, we're just released Culture of Excellence 2.0, which is really, it's an approach where we're building great people, great leaders, and great teams, and really showing folks that, hey, this is what the kind of culture that we want to have in our Navy, because it makes us better warfighters every single day, because it helps us build better warfighting teams.
Absolutely.
And I think having these kind of conversations with our, you know, national, international counterparts, it helps them see, hey, that we can do this too. You know, certainly when I was in Korea, and then when I was most recently in Japan, having opportunities to talk to some of their young naval officers about the opportunities available for them and have some honest conversations about some of the challenges, you know, that they may experience and, you know, ways to get past them have been really good things that we can do.
There's been heavy media discussion about recruitment and retention shortfalls across all the armed forces. And the forces are making strides in a variety of workforce policies initiatives that you just mentioned. I mean, again, it's ultimately about having command climates and places where people want to work and bring their best selves to give the nation the best options we can. So all this is to say, what, in your view, is the Navy's value proposition with Gen Z and soon to be Generation Alpha when it comes to recruitment? Following on from that, when you think about retention, what are the kinds of things that you're focused on?
Sure. Well, you know, all the services are facing some challenges in recruiting, and it's really broader than that. It's probably challenges in just propensity to serve in general.
Okay.
So, you know, these are some ideas about, you know, how do we get out and talk to America about their military? Of course, I want to talk about their Navy. Some people suffer from sea blindness. If you don't live near a coast or you don't live near a base, you may not really know what your Navy does every day.
Sure.
And so talking a little bit about, you know, Operation the Red Sea, keeping commerce flowing, you know, having your Amazon box get to your doorstep. You know, there's a lot of stuff that people don't even recognize every day that your Navy is out there doing. So it's talking to them a little bit about those things. But I think more importantly, you know, I'm the mom of a high school senior. So, yes. So I have a little bit of that Gen Z alpha in my own life. And, you know, thinking about what they value, what they're looking for, you know, in terms of wanting to understand why, wanting to understand the values of the organization. I think we have a really good story to tell because we're all about honor, courage, commitment, democracy, you know, and the pursuit of all who threaten it. Mm-hmm. You know, that is a really good story. But also it's about, you know, helping them become the best version of themselves.
Yeah.
You know, we offer a lot of opportunity. We have 150 different career specialties that they can go into, whether I just created a new robotics rating. So that's a new opportunity for them. But we have cyber, you know, you could be a nuclear engineer, you can be a hospital corpsman, you can really work in any field that you want to. So you can get some of your own skills, test out your own leadership abilities, because we're all leaders in the Navy. And I think those are good things for them to think about. So I really like to have our sailors sell themselves. That's the best way to do it.
Sure.
But we do have a great story for them. I think on the retention side, you know, what I try to instill and what I talk to folks about is, you know, you retain a person, one person at a time.
Yeah.
We need to be the world-class employer for each person. You know, what do they want to achieve? How do they see themselves in the Navy? How do they connect their dot every day to the mission that we're doing so they feel valued? That's our job to do that. You know, we are also focusing on a lot of things that we know some of the younger people are interested in, making sure that folks have access to internet, making sure they have access to the gym, making sure they have access to healthcare, good pay and compensation, making sure they have a place to live that isn't on the ship. Those are some of the priorities. You know, they don't have to walk really far to parking, and when they park, it's safe.
Yeah.
You know, it's some of those smaller things that we don't think about every day. A good quality barracks room, good quality food. You know, folks, they want to have a good life and they want to work hard. And that's some of the work that we're doing to make sure that we can be that world-class employer. And also, I forgot to say my favorite one, join the Navy, see the world. I'm on country 43. You know, you get to travel around with your hotel room, you know, right with you. It parks in the port. You can go out and do some engagement, learn a lot about different cultures, do exercises with different nations. We are that forward deployed force along with our Marine Corps teammates. And it's good to be able to offer that to our leaders. And they can be whatever they want to be in the Navy. Everything is open to them.
But in reflecting on your origin story, you know, you were brought in by, ROTC folks who were just they were the ambassadors for the organization. They brought you in. It's about the individual, isn't it?
It really is.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because everyone's looking for something different.
Yeah.
So I think we've got great opportunities for anybody. You can find yourself, you know, in the Navy, and whether it's a short time or a long time, you'll come out better for it. I do think, you know, we do offer a lot of leadership experience, mm-hmm. and that's a good thing for many people. That maybe they're part of a team, they want to keep being part of a team. Whenever I talk to folks that left the Navy for whatever reason, that's the part they always miss, the camaraderie, the team, the sense of purpose. Yeah. And, you know, certainly in this maritime century, mm-hmm. We got a lot of purpose.
Yeah, that's for sure. As we wrap up today, I'd love your thoughts. If you feel that your gender as a woman has had an impact on your approach to leadership or the decisions that you've taken over the course of your career, and if so, why? But if not, why not? And truly, whatever goes.
Sure. I mean, I don't really ever think about myself, mm-hmm. You know, as a woman
sure.
admiral or woman yeah. surface warfare officer. You know, I really just value the lots of different perspectives
yeah.
I think that everyone brings to the table. Mm-hmm. I think the thing that I've always brought to the table, you know, I was a rower in college, mm-hmm. but not the rower. I'm only 5'2", so I was the coxswain. So, you know, I spent a lot of my time building teams mm-hmm. and getting teams to row together and working hard. And, you know, I think that is what I brought into the Navy is a collaborative approach, mm-hmm. you know, really insisting on, you know, high standards and professionalism and meeting the mission, just like mm-hmm. I did in my boats back mm-hmm. when I was in college. But it's always been as part of a team mm-hmm. With everybody participating equally and really lifting each other up, you know, when folks need a little bit of an extra push, mm-hmm. Pushing together. And when they need a little bit of a break, making sure folks have the break that they need. I think that is what I've been able to bring to the table. I think also focusing on the things that have mattered. I've used that as my own command philosophy for many years, you know, yeah. integrity, people, teamwork, warfighting excellence, safety, and of course, the most important one, attitude makes a difference mm-hmm. Every day, because there's going to be good days, there's going to be harder days, but it's really about how you approach that and how you persevere yeah. And really kind of serve well and always set that example for others. So I think that's probably what I've brought to the table.
Oh, fantastic. Well, Admiral Franchetti, thank you so much for this absolutely terrific conversation. We're honored that you could join us today.
Thank you. Thanks very much, Kathleen. And thanks for doing these. It's really been a great experience to be here with you.
Okay.
Thanks.